On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When No Child Left Behind became the law of the land for American public schools in 2001, George Bush was riding high, and the idea of holding schools accountable for student performance won overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress. Now, after 5 years of testing and often teaching to the test, the whole approach is up for reauthorization. Critics have their knives out, on the left saying we're educating a generation of test-taking drones, on the right, new resistance to federal mandates. In the middle, a yearning for accountability and a rich education. Up next on Point, accountability time for No Child Left Behind. We will hear all sides of the argument in this hour, but first, for a refresher course on No Child Left Behind, we turn to Amit Paley, National Education Correspondent for The Washington Post. Amit, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we were reading earlier in the year that there was going to be a great brawl over whether or not to reauthorize and go forward with this. How's it unfolding? Are we going to see a brawl?
Well, there's already a lot of fighting, and there's been fighting for 5 years on No Child Left Behind, although there is a strong core of support on this, both from the president and from Democrats and Republicans on the Hill. There's also, as you mentioned, tremendous opposition both from the left and the right for completely different reasons in some cases. On the right, there's this sort of conservative rebellion, both among Republicans on the Hill and among even former members of Bush's own administration who helped write the law at the beginning. They have a concern about the federal government getting too big, the federal government sticking its nose into local public schools where they think it doesn't belong. And that's their opposition. On the left, there's a lot of concern that this is the standardization of America, that there's too much focus on testing, 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 and that there isn't enough room for children to express themselves through other means, and that there's a narrowing of the curriculum, getting rid of music and arts. Now, all those points are up for debate, and that's what's been debated this year so far on the Hill. It remains to be seen, though, whether or not there can be any sort of consensus and that the bill can be, the law can be renewed this year.
Amit, take us back and remind us, with the passage of this law and its enactment, what American public schools were required to test their students every year between third and eighth grade and once again in high school for progress in reading and math. Have I got that right?
That's right. And it's testing grades 3 through 8, once in high school, and reading and math. And the goal was to get 100% of children in those subjects to 100% proficiency by the year 2014. So the goal was literally to leave no child left behind. And it was not just overall that the student body in a school would be at 100%, but it would, in fact, test and it would measure in subgroups. So looking at African-American children, looking at immigrant children, English language learners. It would look at disabled children, and it would measure in each of those areas what percentage of those students were reaching 100% proficiency in those subjects.
And if any of those didn't make it, what has happened?
If in any of those subgroups, they failed to meet adequate yearly progress towards that 100% proficiency goal by 2014, the school would have failed to meet its adequate yearly progress, and there would be a series of different repercussions. After 2 years of failing to meet those goals, a school would begin to make some changes and would have to allow children to transfer to different public schools. After 3 years of failing to meet those goals, they'd have to allow children to get free tutoring, either from the school or from private companies to help them. And then after more than that, if they continue failing to meet that goal, there could be much more severe punishments, including takeovers of the school, shutting down of the school, wholesale restructuring of the way everything works there.
So, Amit, what's the report card on No Child Left Behind itself? On the one hand, I see its supporters saying it's working. On the other hand, they also seem to be pushing off that 2014 deadline for proficiency. So if it's working, why not stick with the deadline?
Well, there was a major report that came out by a respected and independent think tank that's been monitoring this, and they found that there has been increases on test scores since No Child Left Behind took place. Now, the debate is over whether those increases in test scores occurred because of No Child Left Behind or whether they occurred because of a series of other reforms that began a decade before No Child Left Behind took effect. And then there are those who argue, should we be measuring progress based on test scores alone? There are a number of people, particularly on the left, who would say the way to measure a child's progress is not just by how they fill in multiple choice bubbles, but how well they are expressing themselves and developing at their own pace as a human being. And now in terms of pushing back the 2014 deadline, although there are some people that would prefer to push it back, the Bush administration has been very firm in saying 2014 is the goal and we do not want to move it, as well as Democrats on the Hill. They worry that if you push that deadline, it loses all meaning and that you just push it back and push it back and you lose the concept of really leaving No Child Left Behind.
I mean, where do the numbers stand on Capitol Hill? Ted Kennedy and George Bush famously cooperated on this when Bush was in the flush of his early popularity and pushed it through. Now you've got on the right Peter Hoekstra, Michigan congressman. We'll talk with him later in the hour. He wants to let states opt out if they want to, which would make it voluntary and kind of take away the big gun there as a conservative pushback against federal control. Do the numbers look like they're there for reauthorization? Can we tell?
Well, it's very hard to tell at this point. As you mentioned, President Bush is still supporting this. The leading Democrats on the House and Senate side and the leading Republicans on the House and Senate side still support No Child Left Behind. So you have this center that continues to support the law, but you do have this problem on the left and the right. As you mentioned, Pete Hoekstra is supporting legislation. It was signed on to now by more than 57 congressmen, and that was a pretty startling number when that came out a few months ago, because it included within it a number of Republicans, some very senior in the hierarchy in Congress, who actually supported the law the first time around. And then on the left, you have a number of people, in particular freshman Democrats, some of whom basically campaigned on opposition to No Child Left Behind with support from the very powerful National Education Association, the teachers union. And so there's concern on from the Democrats that they need to bring along those freshmen and bring along their party as well. So we haven't seen a full bill introduced yet. So until that happens, it might be difficult to gauge what will happen.
Finally, briefly, what's the schedule here? When is this likely to come on the floor of the House and Senate and see action?
Well, that's also up for debate. At the very beginning of the year, Democrats had said that they plan to bring a bill to the committee before the August recess. The Senate has now said that they will not meet that initial goal. And the House, we don't have final word, but it's getting very close to that August recess, and we still haven't seen something. So at least in one body of Congress, it won't come until the fall. And by most accounts, if this doesn't get done by the end of this year, the presidential campaign is going to overwhelm it and make it very difficult for it to get passed. So the countdown is starting right now, and right now it's sort of anyone's guess whether it'll get done or not.
So it'll be back to school with a big battle. In any case, Amit Paley with the Washington Post in Washington. Thanks very much, Amit, for being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about the future of No Child Left Behind. It's up for renewal and facing all kinds of friends and foes. Amy Wilkins is in the Fix It and Keep It camp. She's vice president for government affairs at the Education Trust, a research and advocacy group that focuses on educational equality for poor and minority children. She joins us from Washington. Amy, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. We're looking at this with fascination. It's been a kind of revolution in the classroom. As you well know, not everybody likes it. You're for it. Make the argument for keeping it, and what would you do to improve it?
We're for it because it's working, and there are large populations of kids, low-income kids, kids of color, English language learners, and special ed kids who really hadn't been getting their due in the classroom who now are being focused on. Amit talked about one of the reports that shows that there's progress being made under NCLB. When you look at national studies, what you really see is kids who are kind of at the bottom, who are at the below basic academic skills level, are now moving up. And that tells us that there is progress being made. Without accountability, without schools being required to look at all of these children and to educate all of these children, they were, frankly, languishing and floundering. And now we see movement on behalf of those children.
What's the cost of that progress, Amy? I mean, we hear about music and art being tossed out, history lessons being tossed to the side, teachers narrowing their curriculum just to teach to the test. I mean, is it they're making progress, but is it a rich education? What does it cost to the others in those schools and classrooms? Do we end up with a kind of, society of drones who can take a narrow test but can't really think more broadly?
I don't think so. What we've seen simultaneously as the mathematics and reading scores have gone up as a result of it, of NCLB, is also, and not covered very frequently, are increases in science scores and civic scores. Kids are doing better in other subjects as well, and presumably that is because their reading skills and their mathematics skills are supporting them in those subject areas. You know, I guess what I would say to the narrowing of the curriculum thing, and we do know, and we see too often schools that have made the wrong decision about how to teach children. But you have to be careful here. And the analogy that I use that a lot of people understand is that if you go to the doctor and he says, lose 20 pounds, you've got some choices about how to lose those 20 pounds. Mm-hmm. You can go to the gym, you can change your diet and add more fruits and vegetables and get yourself healthy and strong and lose those 20 pounds. That's what a lot of schools, not enough, but a lot of schools are doing with NCLB. There's another choice you have when the doctor tells you to lose 20 pounds, and that's to go on a starvation diet and to
don't
make
eat.
Yourself sick.
Right.
You don't blame the doctor for telling you you have an issue that you have to address. What NCLB is doing is telling American schools they have issues that they have to address, and some of these schools, it's absolutely true, have addressed the issue in the wrong way. That's why when we're advocating the reauthorization of NCLB, we really are talking about providing schools with richer supports, more technical assistance. We want to show them the way to the gym. We want to get them the fruits and vegetables that they need.
Right now we're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Susan Ohanian, co-founder of a national movement to end No Child Left Behind. It's called the Educator Roundtable. She was a school teacher for 20 years in New York and New Jersey. She joins us from Burlington, Vermont. Susan Ohanian, thanks very much for being here. What's your complaint?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me. Mm-hmm. Well, I would pick up on Amy's metaphor about having to lose 20 pounds. Another way is to cut off an arm and a leg. And I think that's what No Child Left Behind is doing academically and emotionally to America's school children.
What do you mean by that exactly? Take us out of metaphor and into the classroom. What's the impact that you're not happy with?
The narrowing of the curriculum, sending in scripts which teachers must read. The exact words are prescribed in many low-income schools. Teachers with 20 years professional experience are suddenly told they can't do anything they know works but must follow a script. People check up on them at 10:10, you must be on a certain page in the book. Recess is abolished. The whole notion of children learning from one another, having a good time, it's just been wiped out.
If it's working, though, and if it's pulling up the lower tier of our school-age population and giving them advances in proficiency on reading and math, isn't that worth a lot? What about all those years when they effectively, many, just languished and, you know, came out of school without the essentials?
Number one, the increase is minuscule. Number two, one thing behind that increase is the fact that schools are holding kids back in school, hoping that they'll be better able to pass the test next time. So we have examples of kindergartners being held in kindergarten for 3 years in anticipation that they won't be able to do well on that grade 3 test. And we have decades of research that tell us how devastating retention is on children.
So hold them back to help them pass. I want to go to our listeners. They've got a lot of kids in American public schools. From Nashville, Carl is calling. Hi, Carl, you're on the air. What do you see out there?
Well, I tell you, I have five children, third grade to a sophomore in college.
Mm-hmm.
No Kids Left Behind hadn't helped any of my children. And in fact, school itself doesn't help my children to excel. It's me and my wife. We do that. And the problem with that is a lot of children don't have that base at home, so they depend on school. So I think it's a failure because we're teaching children to be drones. We're teaching children to follow the test. For example, my son in the third grade had a teacher that would sneak and teach the children the way she's been teaching for the past 15 years and try and get away from just teaching the children the test. they're not learning how to be individuals, how to discover things on their own.
But Carl, what about the years before No Child Left Behind, when we saw scores that were going nowhere, sitting in the cellar, and, you know, that wasn't working so great, was it?
Well, just because one gun doesn't work as effective, you don't give a child another gun. You understand? Mm-hmm. What you need to do is sit down, see what worked, and go from there. But this right here, after 5 years, five kids, I know for a fact it doesn't work. It only teaches a child how to take a test. It doesn't teach a child how to be an individual and how to think out problems for themselves without the test.
There's a voice of experience, and we hear it loud and clear. Carl, thanks for that. Let's go to Kirksville, Missouri, and Rosalie. Hi, Rosalie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am thrilled to hear the last two callers. I'm a third-grade teacher. I've taught in three states where we had to deal with this problem, aligning our state standards with our curriculum so that we could meet the No Child Left Behind regulations mm-hmm. and expectations so that we wouldn't lose funding. The discipline problems that we've encountered with this testing, we've had to buy new materials, which we feel like are old. You know, they're obsolete. They're brand new. Series reading and math.
But why discipline problems? What does it have to do with discipline?
Because we are forcing these little children to sit with a paper and pencil. They're not discovering for themselves, as your last caller. He is exactly right. Many of those low children have IEPs, but they're being tested just like the regular classroom kids. And the higher children and the middle abilities are really being neglected in this, trying to pull up the bottom. And the only thing that we've gained, that we've all seen, is we all know a lot more about testing and statistics. Teachers know that. We've learned that. We've learned how to align our curriculum. That's the benefit, which makes us more accountable, but it's only on paper.
Rosalie, we've got it, and our time is going. Let me take these critiques to Amy Wilkins. Carl and Rosalie, thanks to you both. Amy, there are two voices from the field, a parent of five who doesn't like it, a third-grade teacher who doesn't like it, for discipline reasons, for narrowed curriculum reasons. What do you say to them?
I would say that probably both of them have legitimate concerns about instructional practice, but that is not what NCLB does. Let's be very clear about what this law does. It tells the states that by... it tells the states by 2014 that they have to get all of the children in their state up to the standards the state has set.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, the law doesn't tell them how. There is lots of room for creativity among teachers. It sets a goal. It says you're going to get all your children here. It doesn't say how you're going to get your children here. So when people talk about it's, you know, moved creativity out of the classroom, it's teaching to the test, those are really local decisions and very bad local decisions.
Well, but let's be realistic. If that's a common problem, is it just somehow baked in the cake of this legislation? Is the pressure such and the resources out there such that if you ask this of schools, this is going to be their response? Amy.
No, because we work with schools every day in every part of this country that are teaching kids richly and well, teaching them to think critically, letting them learn from each other, letting them explore the big questions, where their kids are doing just fine on these tests. These tests really, you know, one of the problems is I think that too many people see these tests as a goal. What we've learned is really good teachers just see these tests. They don't teach to the test. They teach through the test. The test is sort of a gnat on the windshield as the teacher's, you know, taking her kids down the road of education. And I think that one of the things that the polling shows that 70% of the American public wants to see this law reauthorized. I think there is large public support for the law because prior to it, there was no accountability for what was going on in our schools. And, you know, these people are saying, well, you know, creativity is leaving our classroom. This is leaving our classroom. That's leaving our classroom. What we all have to remember is why NCLB was put into place.
Yep.
When NCLB was put into place.
Amy, hold the thought. We know it was tough going there, but Susan, I want to get you on this as well. Amy says, it doesn't have to be a narrowing, dumbing down drone path here. If the teachers just pick it up and do it richly, it can be wonderful. The test is just a gnat on the windshield.
Actually, that's incorrect. As the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education Inspector General reported, The reading first part of No Child Left Behind has very strict requirements. States did not get their money unless the grants they submitted followed very specific guidelines. One of these being an emphasis on DIBELS, which is a way of assessing young children in reading. It's a speed test that requires them to read nonsense syllables, how many they can read in a minute.
But why can't we have it both ways, Susan? I mean, shouldn't American children in public school be presumed that they're going to get proficiency unless they've got some serious learning disability? Shouldn't Americans be able to count on that? And why not test it? Why not know that it's happening?
Well, I think people have to realize that the schools are being asked to narrow a gap which pays no attention to the economic and social reforms needed to do this. People need to look at the work of the economist Richard Rothstein, who's written a lot about this. Where is the attention to closing the gaps in income, health, and housing?
But there it sounds like you may be talking about the work of a century, and we have kids who are being educated right now. They need to know how to read and write.
Yes, they do, and they need to have their teeth fixed. A young boy in Washington, D.C. died of an abscessed tooth. How can this happen in America? And can you imagine what his classroom experience was like when they finally got around to checking his brother's teeth? He had 6 abscessed teeth.
So fix everything. Fix health, fix the economy, fix income distribution.
Richard Rothstein has pointed out in very solid research that if our goal is to raise test scores, if that's all we're interested in, then the cheapest and easiest way to do it is to have a dental clinic in every school.
Because
at any time during the day, any time during the classroom day, a fairly high percentage of children are sitting there with a toothache.
So there's a bigger world than just even the curriculum, as broad as it may be. Let's go to Alexandria, Virginia, and Judith. Hi, Judith, you're on the air.
Hi. In answer to Amy, it is not working. It is an abject failure, and I want to say hi to Susan. She's a personal friend. NCLB is sucking joy from the classrooms. It's turning schools into dreary, giant test prep centers. Full disclosure, I'm on the other end of the spectrum here. I have a child who is in the very high end of giftedness. She aces those tests, and I still hate them. My daughter, fortunately, is in a gifted program. Nevertheless, I became so alarmed at what was happening in the classroom that I pulled her out for a year and decided to homeschool her. I have a child who is a voracious reader. She did not get that way because she was drilled. She got that way because my husband and I love to read. We've always had books all over the house.
But Judith, let me ask you, what if this is what it takes to help pull the bottom tier of our students up? What if your daughter has to have a little more help from you at home so that the average or the lower tier gets to basic proficiency? Is that a necessary sacrifice? Are you willing to make it?
Well, let me answer that with another question. As I said, my daughter is in gifted programs. In Fairfax County, we have gifted, talented centers. I can tell you that the teachers teach to the test because there is tremendous pressure for the gifted kids to score pass advanced. If the gifted kids ace the test, the school looks as if it's doing a lot better than it is. Please tell me how this helps either the gifted child who is being compromised or the low-scoring child. You may assume then that my daughter is a great reader because my husband and I are well-educated and therefore we have books all over the house.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that if she had not been in a gifted program and had been at a regular classroom, and even in the gifted classrooms they were teaching to the test and still continue to be, we are fortunate that my daughter's now in a magnet school that is not teaching to the test. But in the last several years she was. Would I be willing to donate resources so that other children can read too? I still do not believe that struggling readers will read based on this. I see it from my daughter's friends. I talk to kids all the time.
Yeah, so to take this cup away, you'll support it some other way. We hear that and we'll come to it, Judith. Thanks for that. Let me get another caller here from Boston. Marcia, you're on the air.
Hi. We have a program called Learning to Learn where students who've always failed math are doing wonderfully in algebra. And the only reason we have a chance to do well in the schools, so to say, to get into public schools, because we're not Houghton Mifflin, is because of No Child Left Behind. That's because schools are finally needing to look at database programs that really work. And this program allows kids, in fact, to be creative. Students have to create their own problems. They have to do them to 100% accuracy and translate all their math into words.
Right.
You've got kids, classes where kids were failing before, where right now they're vying with each other to see who can get more 100%. And when they go to graph linear equations, they say,
right,
this is the hard stuff. This is great.
So bring it on. And so you see No Child Left Behind is bringing the pressure, raising the pressure to make that happen. Well, look at that. Amy Wilkins, pick up each of these. First, our caller Judith in Virginia says, you know, I've got a gifted child, and even in her classes, it's all teach to the test. Everything's getting skinnied down. I'll support the, you know, the kids at the lower end any way you want, but please not this way.
Well, excuse me. I'm sorry. I think she misunderstands the law, because she spoke about how there's enormous pressure on the gifted students to do well as to balance out the lower end. That the law really doesn't work that way. And on excuse me, on purpose it doesn't work that way, because we don't want the high scores of children like her daughter to wash out the low scores of other students.
But so in practice, maybe people still pay attention to those scores and end up competing on them. I mean, maybe she's talking about the reality of what happens out there.
Yeah, and you know, the reality, again, it sounds like perhaps there's an instructional practice problem, but, you know, what she said she was in a school where they were teaching to the test. She moved her child to another school, another public school, that is still, excuse me, still bound by NCLB, but is not teaching to the test. So within the same school district, she's had two very different experiences. And again, it shows you how much of the decision-making about how to respond to this law is local, and that there are some schools, like the school her daughter is in now, which is making a sensible decision. The other school has made some very bad decisions. And again, we have to help those schools do better.
Susan Ohanian, what about our second caller, Marcia from Boston? She says, you know, her school is innovating in response to the pressure of No Child Left Behind in ways that it might not have otherwise, and she's glad for that.
Well, I don't think the rules have come down in mathematics about which textbooks can and cannot be used to receive No Child Left Behind grants. And for Reading First grants, the rules are very strict, and teachers are not allowed to bring in programs they may know are innovative and effective. The teacher professionalism has really been wiped out by No Child Left Behind.
But here again, she's speaking from the ground, and she's saying something
she's
different.
She's speaking about mathematics. Mathematics has not kicked in with the requirements from the Federal Department of Education. There's not a list of required books yet.
We're joined right now from Washington by Congressman Peter Hoekstra, 8-term congressman representing Michigan's 2nd District, senior Republican member of the House Committee on Education and Labor. He's sponsoring a bill that would allow states to opt out of the No Child Left Behind law. Congressman Hoekstra, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thank you. Good to be with you, Tom.
So you're part of a kind of conservative rebellion. Are you? You're not looking to kill it, but do you want to gut it?
Yeah, that might be a fair and accurate description. I've had lots of interaction with people back in my district, teachers, school administrators, parents, on how effective No Child Left Behind has been. I opposed this bill back in 2001. I thought it was the wrong direction. Everything that I've seen over the last 5 years have confirmed that there's a better way to improve education in America than putting the heavy hand of federal government into every one of our classrooms around the country.
Is that your real gripe? Is this a kind of states' rights, you know, local rights argument that simply ideologically doesn't like it, or do you believe it's not working?
Oh, no, it's not working. This is a philosophical position for myself, that I'm not sure what the federal government's role can be in, you know, my kid's first grade class in Holland, Michigan. Now, my kids are much older than that, but, but it's also taking a look at talking to the teachers in this classroom and saying, you know, it's not working, Pete. There are lots of unintended consequences that have come out of trying to develop a one-size-fits-all education model for America.
An awful lot of Republicans voted for this in 2001 when it first passed. Are they going to stick with it? President Bush is still pushing for it. Why did they do it then? Or if they did it then, why won't they do it now?
Well, I mean, the my belief is, there are a lot of Republicans who voted for that. They wanted to be loyal to their president in 2001, although, they'll have to speak for themselves as why they voted for that bill, which I think philosophically went against every bone that they had in their body when they ran for election. But they voted for it, and, I think in total there were like 41 Republicans and Democrats that voted against that bill. But, I've got a piece of legislation as an alternative to No Child Left Behind that already has over 60 Republican co-sponsors and has some significant interest from Democrats as well to allow these kinds of education decisions to be made at the state and at the local level.
So you wouldn't kill it, but you'd let states opt out of it. How many states do you think would do that? Would it die on the vine if your legislation became law of the land?
I think that there'd be a lot of states that would say, we want the authority, the responsibility to run our schools again. I think there'd be an overwhelming rush of states passing through their legislature, the legislation that says it's our intent and our desire to run our local public schools.
Congressman Hoekstra, what about the record of history here? It was not so great before No Child Left Behind. We had a lot of kids who weren't and still aren't anywhere near proficiency, particularly among poorer American kids in poorer schools. What's supposed to happen with them?
Well, you're right. The record is pretty miserable. But rather than moving accountability and responsibility further away from the schools, further away from the kids who are in the classroom, we have things in Michigan like public school choice that allows parents to move kids from one public school to another based on that school's ability to meet their needs. And so I'm all in favor of increasing public school competition and enhancing parents' abilities to hold schools accountable rather than, our schools being held hostage by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., who don't know the difference, in my case, the difference between the needs of my public schools in Holland versus, Muskegon Heights versus Baldwin or Ludington.
Congressman, take one call with us while you're here. Barbara in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on with Congressman Peter Hoekstra.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been teaching math for 20 years, and in Massachusetts now we have the MCAS test, which is used in relation to the No Child Left Behind.
Right.
And one of the main problems that I see is not with the No Child Left Behind or with the MCAS test, but is with what Amy Wilkins said, people not knowing how to teach. And as long as the blame is put on these things, the test or the law, then the teaching is not going to improve.
So would you keep No Child Left Behind and bump up the teaching quality somehow?
Well, the people need to learn how to teach better. I teach in a working class school. I teach the lower achieving kids. I had 100% passing rate for my 10th graders last year because the kids believed they could do it. And it makes me so sad to hear these teachers and these administrators say, the kids can't do it. Well, if that's their attitude, then the kids won't be able to do it.
No, Barbara, let us take that to Congressman Hoekstra. Pete Hoekstra, what about it? It's not the tests, it's the teaching. Let's keep the pressure on, but improve the teaching, make everything beautiful.
Oh, I think that there's no doubt that we need to keep the pressure on teachers and on schools. Absolutely. I mean, I've visited inner-city schools around the country, and I agree with your caller. I mean, these kids in these schools, sometimes they're labeled, they can't do it, or they come out of the wrong environment. That's absolutely wrong, and these kids can. Their parents have a passion for getting these kids into an environment, into a school, and into a classroom with a teacher that has a passion for education and knows how to get through to these kids. The difficulty many times is the things that a teacher needs to do to be successful are things that aren't measured on a test. We talked about a teacher teaching math or science.
Yep.
There's one method maybe to get a teacher that a teacher can use to get a kid to pass a test.
But is basic proficiency too much to ask, no matter how they teach? I mean, shouldn't good teaching achieve that?
No, the basic proficiency, no, it is. There's nothing wrong with with the measurements and the accountability.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, where is that accountability going to rest, and who has the greatest ability to impact and improve the schools? And I think the movement, the closer we can have the accountability to the school, the better off we are, rather than having, you know, we used to go to the Department of Education.
Yep.
And ask them, you know, who reads these reports that come from the states, and what kind of value add does somebody here call my schools back in Holland and said, you know, we've reviewed your test results, and based on the test results, here are our recommendations for how you improve your school.
Congress,
that doesn't happen.
Yeah, last question for you.
Yeah.
This bill, this legislation, law expires at the end of September. If we don't have something new, it gets a one-year extension automatically. That will put us right in the middle of a presidential campaign. Is this going to die by default here? Congress doesn't act, then we're in the middle of the campaign, nothing happens next year, and it just goes away without a vote?
No, but these programs don't go away. They keep being funded and reauthorized through the appropriations process. You know, I mean, you know, the number of programs that are out there that the authorization has expired would be enough to fill a dictionary. So no, the law would not go away. It would just keep operating exactly the way it is. It'd be called an unauthorized. But the language would be in an appropriations bill that says, we authorize the program, and here is the money to make it go. So, no, it would not go away.
So it's going to take a fight. If it's going to go away, it sounds like you're bracing for it. Congressman Peter Hoekstra from Michigan's 2nd District, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, good to be with you. Thank you.
Amy Wilkins, there's the argument for local control. Get the federal government out of off our backs here. Let us do it, and we will do it.
Well, you know, Mr. Hoekstra's law, with all his bill, with all respect, is sort of unnecessary, because right now states can opt out of NCLB. The requirements of NCLB only follow the money. If a state says, we want nothing to do with this accountability system, they don't have to take the money.
But everybody wants and needs the money, so everybody's in.
Mr. Hoekstra is saying, here's a bunch of money from the federal government, from federal taxpayers, and we're not going to hold you accountable for it at all. I don't think that's really being sort of an effective steward of federal resources.
Well, yes, the money would still flow under his plan, but they could opt out of the requirements. But if we care about education, maybe the money's important. Maybe it's necessary. Why not let local school boards and school teachers take the money and pursue the goals as they see best?
Well, again, when you look at the history of education in America, particularly for low-income kids and kids of color, but, you know, when we look overall at American achievement, you know, when you look across the world, our kids, even our, you know, most affluent kids are getting our lunches eaten by kids in other countries. The sort of system that we have has not served our children well, and there is not a lot of point of pouring, you know, more federal money into very broken bodies.
So if it doesn't stay, if people back off of No Child Left Behind, do you see it as an abandonment of kids of color, or more, forget color, kids at the low end of the totem pole economically?
Absolutely. That this country sort of has been on a uneven march towards educational equity for all of our citizens. No Child Left Behind, while not perfect, was a big mile marker toward progress.
Mm-hmm.
I think that not reauthorizing this law or gutting this law would be a huge step backwards for all Americans, because we are such an interconnected society that, you know, we can't. You know, when we leave low-income kids behind, or when we leave kids of color behind, we really are damaging the collective whole of our nation.
Mm. Let me take a call from Martin in South Carolina. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I live in a rural school district down here in South Carolina that was taken over by the state 5 years ago.
Is that because it was failing to meet No Child Left Behind standards? Okay.
Well, I'm not sure if the No Child Left Behind standards were the reason, but the schools were definitely failing.
All right.
Money's been pumped in. In fact, our school district has the highest per capita amount of money spent on students in the state.
Mm-hmm.
We have had good teachers that brought in through the visa programs. We've had teachers come in from India that have just been excellent teachers. And in all of that time, the schools have not improved. The performance is miserable. Next week, the state superintendent is coming down because the school is being turned back over to local control. I hear about the sanctions of you know, the heavy hand coming in. Well, we've seen the heavy hand here in our school district, and it hasn't done a thing. The positive note, earlier person was talking about having a dental clinic. The Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine put a dental clinic. They're a medical order,
right,
and
they
put a dental clinic in the front yard. You know, so we do have a dental clinic.
So good for you. But what's your sense of the bottom line problem here? Do we need national standards to hold your schools there to account, and at least, you know, illuminate the problem and prod them toward fixing it, or will it really be better if No Child Left Behind backs off and leaves the local community to deal with it?
Tom, I don't have an answer. I'm sorry, but you know it. I don't have an answer for you.
And I'm sorry. I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm wishing the best for you there, Martin. Thanks for that. Let me get a call from Brooklyn, New York. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what one of your speakers said a while ago about the poverty behind it, and it seems to be going on in this rural community also that the last speaker just spoke about.
Maybe.
I have had students come in who are starving because they haven't eaten since lunch that was given to them free. I've had kids come in from the hospital because their families beat them. What do you think they are concentrating on in that classroom? It is certainly not, no matter how much you want them to pass a test, that's not what they're going to be able to do, because we're not looking at the poverty behind it. We're talking about low-income kids. We're talking about children of color here. We need to fix that part of it if we are ever going to fix the education part.
But what do we do in the meantime, Laura? I mean, I'm all for it, but it's a tall order. If it takes decades to fix the poverty, what about the education of those kids?
Well, we need to come up with something. No Child Left Behind has its merits, but it needs to be fixed so that those kids are also, in the meantime, while we're trying to fix the poverty, are not just being taught the test. Because I can tell you right now, that was all I was instructed to do. And those children don't get music. Those children don't get art. And their lives are not going to be as fulfilling as the other children that do have those opportunities, because we're worried about those low-income kids passing a test. And I don't know, no one has brought up the cheating aspect about this, how easy it is to cheat on those tests.
I mean,
and teachers will do it because their scores matter.
Wow. Laura in Brooklyn, thanks very much. Amy Wilkins, there's a whole litany there, but at the bottom of it, the sort of argument that this is a patch on a bigger problem, and it won't fix it. No Child Left Behind won't fix the poverty, won't fix the context, the environment, you know, that brings in kids not ready to learn, without food in their stomach.
I hear that argument. And, you know, it is criminal in a country as wealthy as ours that there are children who come to school not having eaten. It is criminal that there are children in this country who aren't getting health care. But we cannot set a lower set of standards for low-income children or children of color. That is, you know, should be offensive to every American. Mm. If we think about it carefully, the only chance, the best chance those kids have to get out of those horrendous circumstances are good schools. Their teachers are their best allies in their struggle against poverty. And so when you have teachers who say, I can't teach this child because she or he is so poor, it breaks my heart and it terrifies me, because really that teacher is the best friend that kid has.
Mm-hmm. Susan Ohanian, are you just going to knock the ladder out from underneath those kids, take away the pressure to do better for them, or do you really have something to offer as an alternative?
Well, I think you really must pay attention to the poverty problem. The media does not give attention to the fact that UNICEF rated the 20 developed nations in child well-being, and the U.S. came out 19th, just above Mexico. I taught children of poverty and children of color for 20 years, and I'll tell you, I was a very good teacher. I did not have lower standards for them than from other students in the school. But to put this burden on schools when we should be putting the burden on our society and on our corporate politicals to raise the family income.
Wrong place to put the burden, you say. The big debate will go on. Anyway, we appreciate the context behind it and around it from each of you. Susan Ohanian at the Educator Roundtable joining us from Burlington, Vermont. Susan, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Amy Wilkins, thanks for your work and thanks for your observations today. Amy Wilkins at the Education Trust, Vice President for Government Affairs there. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.